none of it made sense to me. But how did you understand it from your perspective, being in the medical community?
Yeah, none of it made sense to me either. You know,
Okay.
our core values as healthcare providers are informed consent, evidence-based practice, and individualized patient care. And I saw all those being thrown out the window in the most egregious ways by my own hospital's leadership.
Welcome to Love and Life. I'm Dr. Karen Anderson-Abril, here with my co-host,
Pastor Elliot Anderson.
And Love and Life is your place to hear conversations grounded in psych research, psychotherapy,
and biblical truth
to help us thrive in love and life. Welcome to part two of my conversation with psychiatric nurse Dave Wayne. If you haven't listened to the beginning of this interview, please check out episode 298, in which we talk about Dave's career journey. He moved from thinking people who criticized Big Pharma were conspiracy theorists to condemning pharmaceutical corporations himself and wondering how they remain viable despite their recurring criminal behavior. Part two of my discussion with psychiatric nurse and holistic health coach Dave Wayne, right after this. We want to take a moment to say a quick thank you to our community for supporting our sponsor, The Wellness Company. We've been so thrilled to partner with their team of esteemed medical professionals, including Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Harvey Risch, Dr. Drew Pinsky, and other truth-seeking doctors we can trust. Many of us are feeling some post-pandemic uncertainty, which makes perfect sense because now they're talking about this disease X that's supposedly about to break out at any time. But we can take charge of our health and prepare ourselves for natural disasters or man-made threats with the Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit. It's the ultimate safeguard for your family. The kit includes vital medications like ivermectin, amoxicillin, and Z-Pak with a comprehensive guidebook researched and written by the company's chief medical board. Visit twc.health/lovelife and use promo code LOVELIFE for an exclusive 15% discount. That's twc.health/lovelife and promo code LOVELIFE, all one word, for 15% off your order.
Yeah, I bet that's a lot nicer than things have been for me, because it's not been fun to have your belief system kind of crumble underneath you.
Mm-hmm. And you had professional connections, and when you parted ways with that, you lost friends, you lost community. You spoke about community earlier. I'm sure you found new community in this more holistic approach, but that couldn't have been easy. And people feeling like you're judging them now, that you've taken a different stance, or that you think you know more than them. I'm sure there was a lot of various dynamics at work with your relationships.
Yeah, there were a lot of dynamics at work. And for a while, I was actually, you know, for as distressed as I was very motivated. Like, well, you know, I'm actually well-positioned on my unit to at least change things in my neck of the woods. You know, I have mm-hmm. the respect of my coworkers already. I've even as a nurse, I have enough influence here that I can start to change things. So I did. I started to redo our patient education handouts so they weren't written by Merck anymore, and started doing that sort of thing just to well, I can't change the FDA. I can't change leadership at Merck or Pfizer, but I can change things at my hospital, and I started to. And then COVID happened, and that kind of put all that stuff on the back burner. And then vaccines came out, and then vaccine mandates came out. And through all that, I was seeing so many red flags that were there with other pharma scandals that it made me skeptical and cynical, and made me want to wait. And my hospital took a very hardline stance on vaccination, and I responded strongly to that. Especially as a psych nurse, you know, people come to our unit against their will. They're behind double locked doors, and there are times where people are given medications against their will, and I was always one to advocate for somebody's right to refuse, and that you right. do not cross that line lightly. You
right.
You do not violate informed consent without absolutely being able to justify it. And what I saw was the leadership at my hospital just throw that right out the window for their own staff in the most deplorable ways. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't allow their own doctors to consider medical exemptions for their patients if somebody had a vaccine reaction and they didn't want to get another dose. It wasn't up to their own doctor to decide whether or not that was right or not. I'm not even sure who made that decision at this point, if it was hospital leadership or human resources or who it was. But they said, initially they said no religious exemptions, no natural immunity exemptions, no exemptions at all whatsoever. Do this or you're terminated. So I was a very outspoken critic of all that and ended up being terminated.
Not surprised.
No, not surprised.
Go ahead.
A lot of people were kind of pushed out of the healthcare establishment mm-hmm. at that point in time. The sort of people that, if you have a loved one in the hospital, those are the people you want there taking care of them. Those are the people you want there to be their advocate when family isn't there. And a lot of them were pushed out of the system and don't work in healthcare anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good situation we're in. We already had a staffing crisis, and things are not getting better.
How did you make sense of that? I've never worked in a hospital setting or anything along those lines. As I've already shared with you, I was always a little skeptical based on my father's philosophy that he instilled in me. And how did you make sense of that? That this complete, like you said, just informed consent out the window, any prior religious or medical exemption, vaccine, someone has a anaphylactic shock or something that happens. People are allergic to things that can be in these vaccines. I'm talking about regular vaccines or whatever. And all of that was thrown out the window. How did you come to understand that? As an outsider, I just got real cynical about all of it. And I became, I don't know if I could have been more cynical, but here I am, more cynical. So how did you, being in the system, and of course you'd already begun your own journey of seeing the medical community in general differently, but when these hospitals had this very heavy-handed, and I was wondering, is it because so many hospitals are now hospital groups and doctors don't have private practices to the same extent? I know some surgeons will have privileges at certain hospitals, but it seemed like the medical, I'm probably not even using the right word, but like the hospital administration, they were getting some word from Lord Fauci, and then that was it, end of story? And like you said, no connection between the patient and the doctor and understanding each individual's biology, much less the fact that no one should be forced to take an experimental anything. I mean, that, of course, none of it made sense to me. But how did you understand it from your perspective, being in the medical community?
Yeah, none of it made sense to me either. You know, our core values as healthcare providers are informed consent, evidence-based practice, and individualized patient care. And I saw all those being thrown out the window in the most egregious ways by my own hospital's leadership. And it was, you know, they would host these town hall sessions, our hospital leadership, where staff would submit questions and then leadership would answer. And there were all these female staff reporting menstrual cycle changes after vaccination. Everyone was talking about it. You know, if they had downtime on their shift, it was a very common topic of conversation. People were saying, you know, this is like a once in a lifetime. Like, I don't know what's going on. I'm genuinely scared. It's gotten so bad. And it was happening to all these nurses and other healthcare professionals after vaccination. And they brought that up with hospital leadership, who basically implied that they were conspiracy theorists and that they need to get their news from other sources. And they were in social media groups that were then deleted, and people had accounts banned. And I'm watching this happen around me, like, is this real life right now?
Right.
And we also saw it happen at the local level with our local media, because we had staff at the hospital reach out to the local media to bring them information about what was going on at the hospital with COVID and with vaccines that were not things that were being covered. One of the things that happened at my hospital after so many staff were fired was they brought in unvaccinated travel staff from the other hospital in town that had fired people. They called in a National Guard to help with staffing, and some of them were unvaccinated. And we went to the media like, hey, do you want to do a story about the fact that this hospital who just fired all their unvaccinated staff brought in a bunch of unvaccinated people to replace them? And that started me down another rabbit hole that made me quite cynical, because what I found out was that my small town paper was actually owned by a giant corporation with all these financial entanglements with none other than Pfizer. And so we brought photos and videos and testimony and other evidence to our so-called local paper, and instead of running any of that, they would run articles along the lines of how to help your child overcome a fear of needles for their upcoming COVID vaccine and that sort of thing. And it was surreal and dystopian, and seeing those things play out at the local level like that was very disturbing.
We'd love to connect with you further via our weekly newsletter. Joining the Love and Life family gets you first access to bonus content and flash sale pricing for books and consultations.
And when you sign up, you'll receive Karen's Empowered Dating Playbook or my Empowered Marriage Playbook. Head over to loveandlifemedia.com to join the Love and Life family.
This, I could go in so many different directions with this. I think we had very similar experiences. You were right on the front lines. I was watching this truly in shock, like you said, surreal. I remember it was maybe right after the 2 weeks to slow the spread. And I got on the internet because I couldn't believe that there was no balanced conversation, that this was all so hyperbolic. And even the early statistics showed that, I think and I don't even know how this truth was actually able to be disseminated, whereas others bits of truth were hidden, but that if you were over 75, you still had like a 1% chance of dying from COVID. Now, of course, I'll go down the rabbit hole that I'm guessing you went down too. I don't know, COVID, dying of COVID, dying with COVID, dying of hospital procedures that were horrific, ventilators, remdesivir, all of that. But before I knew any of that, and my mother's over 75, and I remember going, well, she's not obese. She doesn't have type 2 diabetes. She doesn't have any comorbidities. She's not, if 99 people are going to make it out over 75, she's one of them. And so she never took the jab. I mean, all of this just, I still, to this day, I don't understand where the logic went. People who are very, very bright, but allowing themselves, like you're just saying, where's the logic where you fire unvaccinated nurses and then bring in unvaccinated people and they can have the job? What? Again, make it make sense. Make it make sense.
Yeah, so much of it made absolutely no sense. And I was seeing that. I was also on our hospital's technology committee, software and technology. And so, one of the things I noticed on the psych unit is we would get patients on the psych unit who would test positive for COVID, and they wouldn't have so much as a sniffle, but they would be counted as a COVID hospitalization. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, how often is this happening? How much of our local and then state and then federal hospitalization numbers are people who are hospitalized for something other than COVID? They just happen to swab positive on a test that has like, that's almost like a coin flip on whether or not you're going to swab positive. And that was built right into the software. They had one diagnosis code for people who were positive for COVID, and that drove that drove hospital reimbursement. So it gave hospital administrators financial incentive, an incredible financial incentive to not have a problem with the fact that we only have one diagnosis code for people with COVID and we have no way to distinguish people who are hospitalized with incidental COVID. So it completely threw off our numbers. And I also saw how our software was incapable of accurately tracking who's actually been vaccinated and who isn't. Our healthcare system is so fragmented. None of these various players play well together. If you get a vaccine at Walmart, Walgreens doesn't know that. The hospital doesn't know that. The county doesn't know that. Their systems don't talk. They might talk to your state vaccine registry, but they might not. So we were seeing all these people hospitalized on our COVID unit. I know this from talking to the people who worked on that unit who, you know, they would get their vaccine at their nursing home or they would get vaccinated at the VA and they would be counted as an unvaccinated hospitalization because those systems weren't talking. And this isn't anything new. This isn't anything conspiratorial. Like when they set up these systems back in the late 90s, every state set up their own system with their own state laws and their own software and their own hardware. And it's never shared well. And this is known by our federal agencies too. CDC knows this, HHS knows this, FDA knows this, but for some reason, this knowledge of this issue that goes back decades just magically went out the window for COVID, and all these vaccines got labeled safe and effective. It was so egregious to me. There was actually a point in time where I was getting really, really hopeful, like, oh, finally, like more doctors, more people in positions of authority are going to wake up. Like, this is so obvious and so over the line that, like, finally we're going to get some systemic reform. But alas, here we are. If anything, people have just doubled down even more and keep the blinders on. You look at who we're giving COVID vaccines to in this country and compare it to the rest of the world, it's pretty wild. We give COVID boosters to 5-year-olds in this country, and in France they don't give it to you if you're healthy and under 80 years old. In a lot of countries it's 65. Like, sorry, we're done vaccinating anybody under 50 years old, under 65 years old in most of the rest of the Western world, and here we are, you know, giving 5-year-olds boost number 4 at this point or whatever it is, can't even keep track. It's like, what are they looking at in their data that we're not seeing in ours?
Because kids were always at horrible risk, weren't they?
Right. Yeah.
Well, did they end up getting it on the CDC childhood vaccination schedule? I don't even remember. I lost track of where they were able to. Yeah. Well, so then now they're not liable.
Right, that gives them liability protection. So yeah, if anybody is interested in a lawsuit, there's just liability protections to the left and right from the PrEP Act and from the 1986 vaccine laws. There's no chance for people who've been injured to seek any sort of legal remedy. It's so broken and it's so over the top. I still don't understand how more healthcare professionals aren't awake to the game at this point. You know, it doesn't matter what specialty you work in, you should be aware of frauds with medications that you've given to people at this point. You know, where you find out later just how predatory and bad the frauds were, that, you know, it should plant a little bit of seed of skepticism in you to just blindly trust pharma companies and blindly trust federal institutions. It's beyond naive at this point. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to talk with you. One of my passions in life really, it, I would love to see a complete overhaul of our, I don't know. Okay, that sounds, I get overwhelmed sometimes. It's so overwhelming. I would love to see an overhaul of pharmaceutical corporations' relationships to the medical community. As we said earlier, they're so in bed together. And even bringing it back to the psychological realm, I just read an article, or heard a podcast rather, in Mad in America, which is one of my favorite podcasts. And it's, for anyone who doesn't know about it, it's a podcast that really looks at the effects of psychotropic medications on people, the things we've been speaking about today, and has a lot of personal stories and people who have successfully been able to taper off and re-engage in life, because so often, as you spoke to as well, many of these medications basically flatline you. You just become numb and you don't have the fullness and thriving of life. All that to say, they had these two researchers on who talked about the DSM-5-TR and just raising awareness, something that you and I, we did this digging long time ago. I had Dr. Alan Francis on my podcast several years ago, and he was the chair of the steering committee for the DSM-4. And when the DSM-5 came out, he was appalled at how medicalized it was. And he wrote this book, Saving Normal. It's amazing. Mm. And that will really help someone if they're curious about waking up. Also, The Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker is another great place to start if anyone's interested. And then, of course, we talked about Dr. Peter Breggin's work. But these researchers, and they were very gracious. I was a little bit more cynical. They were just talking about implicit bias. So all these psychiatrists, so these are medical doctors, so they have a much more medicalized view of the world in general. Because they have that view of the world, they are more comfortable probably going to medications as a first response, first step. And these are the folks who are determining. They're sitting in a task force committee meeting and saying, what is called a diagnosis? Now, let's just break it down. How sad do you have to be to have clinical depression? These are the kinds of things that they're trying to figure out. It's much easier on a physical realm. You can take my blood work and see if I have low levels of this, that, and the other, hormones and so forth. With emotional, the emotional realm, it's much harder to decide, okay, at what point is Karen sad enough that she is depressed? And we give her that label and that diagnosis. And what these researchers had found, and we'll link to this study, is that 60% of these psychiatrists had clear conflicts of interest, meaning that they were being paid money by pharmaceutical companies. My cynical mind goes in a lot of different directions. But these researchers were saying, well, it's just the implicit bias. If you're getting money to see a condition as a medical problem, a psychiatric illness that needs medicine to treat it, if you're being paid to see the world that way, of course you're going to see the world that way. And when you're on the task force, you're going to be raising your hand saying, oh no, I think that XYZ psychotropic is the way to go. Even at the diagnostic level. So this is why I take issue with a lot of this generation, meaning all of us, not just the younger kids, but we are so mental health aware that now I have anxiety, my social anxiety, my depression. To internalize these diagnoses is very, again, it's very, the beneficiary of me internalizing a diagnosis is Eli Lilly's going to make more money. So it's so pervasive and systemic. How do you see this level of it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost monetized. It's almost like you get some sort of social credit to be young and to have a diagnosed mental illness these days. And it's something that's perplexed me. You know, when I grew up, it was sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And early in my career in mental health, it was all about teaching people about resilience. It was that, yeah, life is not fair. You are going to have bad things happen to you, and you need to have strength, internal strength, and you need to have connections to other people in order to get through them. And you know, we would recognize that dichotomous thinking is bad. Not everything is black and white. There is a lot of gray area. And then all of a sudden, in just the span of a few years, all of a sudden we're encouraging people to outsource their own emotional well-being to the validation of strangers, and almost nurturing dichotomous thinking. Everything over here is good, everything over here is bad, and it to me it seemed especially egregious that so many mental health professionals got on board with that right away, because we're the ones who are supposed to know better. So that was kind of happening in parallel to my knowledge about the side effects of all these medications too, where I was looking at how we were all of a sudden starting to treat especially youth so differently than we had in the past, it was yet another area of my job as a nurse where I was going, are we helping here, or are we actually doing harm with what we're teaching people and giving people?
Yeah, it's there's another great book you probably are familiar with, Coddling of the American Mind, and it talks exactly what you said. Certainly in the university settings, about 2015, 2014, trigger warnings. All of a sudden, if I remember, there was a snippet from the book where there was a law professor and he was going to talk about if you violate the law. And he had a trigger warning at the beginning of that lecture to say, in case anyone had been physically violated in any way, shape, or form, just that we're going to use the word violated. And this notion that we are so fragile, that we're so fragile because of whatever, again, XYZ diagnosis we've decided we feel. And then that internalizing, like we've talked about already today, to me, it's so disempowering and it's so inaccurate. And it does reinforce, as you spoke to a moment ago too, the black and white cognitive distortions that we learn about in my cognitive therapy training, that we want to separate from them. We want to rewire our cognitive, our cognitions so that we can think in a more healthy, positive, effective, adaptive manner. We want to challenge those and dispute those cognitive distortions. And here, currently, we're doing the exact opposite. We're continuing to reinforce cognitive distortions that we know through the research make us miserable. And yet our peers in the mental health community are absolutely reinforcing this. It's very troubling.
Yeah, it is very troubling. It is very troubling. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm baffling. David, as we wrap up today, let's talk about the positive, what you are doing now, and the empowered way to manage life's ups and downs. None of this that we're talking about today is meant to minimize anyone's distress. That's the other thing I get sometimes, is that people, because I don't want to go to pharma, because I'm skeptical of all that, because I want to talk about talk therapy as a better approach, nutrition, exercise, sunlight, grounding, all the things, people sometimes feel that I'm minimizing their experiences. And I know that you are not about that either. So talk about what your approach can do for folks and why you believe it is a way better way to move through emotional vicissitudes of life.
Sure. Yeah. So on a whim, because of some social media influencers, my girlfriend decided to try a carnivore diet to address her longstanding autoimmune disease. So she has ankylosing spondylitis, which causes basically arthritic pain, especially in her central spine and in her joints. And she had been on various medications, including Vioxx, over the past 20 years. And she heard some people on social media talking about how the carnivore diet, this crazy all-meat diet, put their symptoms in remission, and she decided to give it a try. And a few months pass, and all of a sudden she's taking less of her pain meds. She's needing less of those. She's off her blood pressure meds. She's losing weight, feeling better, sleeping better, more energy. And we started to become involved in carnivore communities where we would, she started attending coaching groups online. So we would meet people through that, and we would go to different in-person meetups where people would, you know, go out and have barbecue somewhere and share their stories, share their journeys. And it was it always made my ears perk up because so many of these people had something in common. They all had autoimmune diseases, and that's how they kind of started down the path of carnivore, found carnivore, started changing their diets, removing seed oils, removing processed foods, that sort of thing. And they would talk about all the incredible benefits. You know, their pain's gone, they're losing weight, and almost as just a happy incidental side effect, they would say, oh, and by the way, my anxiety and depression are way better too. And they would basically sing the praises of how much better their mental health was after cleaning up their diet. And it was, I had never heard somebody say that to that degree about their antidepressant or about their antipsychotic, like, oh, lithium is just, or their mood stabilizer, you know, like Zyprexa is just the most wonderful thing. Like, no, you know, these people. Oh, and well, the other interesting thing about it too was that there was no placebo effect there. We talked a little bit about the clinical trials for SSRIs and how the placebo effect is a big deal with those. And these, none of these people were changing what they ate to address their mental health, but they were all noticing this incredible improvement in it. So started me down another rabbit hole. So reading Brain Energy by Chris Palmer, connecting with different influencers in the carnivore community, and just keep hearing over and over that mental health and metabolic health are completely intertwined. That if there is a valid you know, chemical imbalance theory of depression, it's not that you're deficient in Prozac. It's you need to look at things like what you're eating and your, you know, your thyroid and your vitamins, and avoiding seed oils and ultra processed foods, and just eating a proper human diet can take so many people so far. And instead of having, you know, side effects like a black box warning about suicidality and weight gain and emotional numbing and sexual side effects, you have all these incredible side effects like losing weight and having more energy and you know, connecting to people, and it's provided quite the contrast to the system that I was kind of embedded in for so long, and it's given me hope that at least through different grassroots projects, we might actually be able to make some changes and you know, get people on track to eating their way to better mental health rather than going down that road of popping more pills and having another prescription added or having their prescription changed and that sort of thing.
Well, that's exactly, and Dr. Palmer's work, and he's getting traction. I mean, he's on big podcasts, and I think he just got a grant from Harvard. I'm on his mailing list, so I think he just got some big donor or some big fellowship or something at Harvard, which is where he is, but there's going to be an entire nutrition as it relates to mental health initiative, I believe. So that's very exciting. And it's interesting because now our other foe, David, is big food, of course.
Exactly. Exactly. You know,
you go down the one road and then you end up that, oh, they're in bed together too. But talk about when a client comes to you, talk a little bit about the process and what you're able to offer them. Because you're working with Primal, right?
Yeah, so I'm recently certified as a primal health coach, and so I've got a website up, and I'm working on my program now. And to be honest, I'm struggling with what to offer people, because I feel like a lot of this stuff should be free. Like people, there shouldn't be a paywall, and you shouldn't have to go to somebody with letters behind their name to have good mental health or to get help with your depression and anxiety. So I'm still trying to figure out how to monetize things, because I do want to make a living at this, but I also want this to be available to everyone. I don't want there to be any sort of barrier to payment. I mean, you know, working in mental health for as long as I have, it's the people who need it the most often, you know, aren't able to afford it. So that's the dance I'm trying to navigate right now. It doesn't feel right to me to charge people a lot of money for one-to-one coaching. So it's a work in progress, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in having people, you know, not necessarily through the carnivore diet, but through a proper human diet that may or may not be carnivore, but basically, you know, less sugar, less carbs, less seed oils, that sort of thing. Exercise, sleep hygiene, get their mental health under control with as few medications as possible. Hopefully zero meds if possible.
And with your training, did they talk about, because I always think it's important, because I talk about this a lot, but the research shows it's very unwise to just go cold turkey. David talked about that a little bit earlier. From if you decide you're on board with this philosophy and this way of living, tapering off your medications is a much more healthier way to do it, as opposed to going cold turkey. And then did they talk about that in your training, or was that something separate that you've addressed?
No, that's something separate that I'm still working on educating mm-hmm. myself about. That wasn't ever part of something that I have learned as a mental health nurse. So I'm just starting to learn about hyperbolic mm-hmm. tapering, basically on my own time. Yeah. But as a nurse, I also don't have prescribing rights, so it's mm-hmm. not I can't directly change anybody's medications, and people who are doing hyperbolic tapers, depending on the medication, depending on how long they've been on it, depending on their own personal physiology, it's something that can take months to years, and that's also not necessarily like appropriate for a coaching relationship either to last that long. So, but that's also something I'm very interested in. So, some of the things I think about are starting online communities for people who are trying to do this, for people who have PSSD, or for people who are working on tapering off of their psychotropics. I think there's a lot of benefit that can come from crowdsourcing both problem solving and emotional support for people who've been harmed by the mental health system and are trying to get things back on track. So that's kind of the direction I'm leaning towards right now with setting up a business is that mm-hmm. a community model, because one thing I know is I definitely do not have answers myself. That you know, these are things that I think crowdsourcing problems is very powerful. It's disturbing to have gotten this far in my career as a healthcare professional, where, you know, in nursing school the mantra was evidence-based practice, and I've gotten to a point where I believe next to nothing that I read in a journal anymore. I've gotten so cynical. It used to be so simple because I could just read a study's conclusions and go, well, I know that. And now I have to look at their conflicts of interest and does their data actually match their conclusions? And was there a ghost author and who funds the journal that published it? It's made it exponentially more complicated to even know what to trust to the point where it's paralyzing. And I at this point, trust anecdotes more than I trust something I'll read in a journal, which is not how it's supposed to be. And I know that. And as somebody who believes in evidence-based medicine, I know that that's sounds funny to say, but it's I feel like that's the situation we're in at this point. So
I completely resonate with that. So when I was getting my doctorate, it was exactly what you said. People would raise their hand maybe the first month before they realized you don't do this and be like, say we're in a developmental psychology class, we're talking about aging and geriatric population, and someone raises their hand, well, my grandma, you never went to that N of one. Never, ever. You would look like just so infantile.
Yeah.
As if your grandma's one little experience had anything to do with what we know about 75-year-old populations based on all the research. And now that I know that the pharmaceutical corporations have bought all the medical journals, they're funding all of them. And like you said, you can have data in a study and the discussion and interpretation can completely not match. Doesn't matter. Just because they're assuming people are reading the abstract and the discussion. So you go to this point where when I start my podcast, I would always have a study that I would refer to no matter what I was talking about. And now I go, I don't trust those studies anymore. And then where are you left? What are we left with?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for your time. How can people reach out to you if they want to learn more about, I know it sounds like you're still building your whole practice now as a coach, but you've got your certification and you are potentially going to do some groups and so forth. I always love to know that if someone approaches us and that's not something we're doing, that we have people we can refer them to. So please let people know how they can get a hold of you if they'd like to learn more.
Sure. I've got a website called describe.health.
Went
with describe both because of my interest in deprescribing, but also because of my interest in using mindfulness skills to help people with mental illness and help people on their path to recovery.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's another podcast episode we could talk about the mindfulness literature.
Yeah, yeah.
Although we probably don't trust the literature anymore. So we'll talk about our anecdotes.
Right, exactly.
Thank you again so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, as always, for listening and for being part of the Love and Life family. We hope this information has been supportive and empowering and may help you think about describing and moving to thriving pharma-free. And until next time, make it a great week.
Love and Life is produced by Tim May and hosts and executive producer, Dr. Karen Anderson-Abril.